You're listening to Stealing from Wizards, Volume 2, Burglary, by R.A. Consul. Chapter 6, Lodging. The princess crashed through the veil around Avalon to gasps of relief and wonder from the first-year students on the deck. Crow considered how quickly he and his friends had grown accustomed to the ferry's habit of driving at full speed towards shorelines. They all sat with absolute confidence that the boat would pass safely through the thin spot in the veil and would not wreck itself on the barren, rocky shore of the Blandland side of the island. What they had not gotten used to, though, was the assault on the senses that accompanied the return to the Fey Realm. After hours in the dull, muted world of the Blandlands, the return to the vibrant colors, crisp sounds, and distinct aromas was overwhelming. The fact that they were pulling into the spring quarter of Avalon Island made it even more so. The rainbow of flowers in bloom dazzled the eye, and each scent took up individual residence in the nose. Every leaf sang out its precise location as it rustled in the gentle breeze. It was so staggeringly beautiful that Kuro was glad he was sitting down. Even Azalea expressed a measure of delight and inhaled as though it were the first real breath of air she'd had in hours. Charlie jumped from her seat and started dragging the new students around the deck to show them the features of the island. She explained the fortress-like high school perched atop the massive pillar of stone that rose from the center of the island. She pointed out the gently falling snow just visible to the north in the winter quarter. She talked about the school crest, which was worked into the pavement by the pier in interlocking colored bricks, representing the Four Kingdoms, an intricate interwoven pattern for Tirnanog, a fleur-de-lis for Acadia, a raven for Alfheim, and a maple leaf for the Autumn Kingdom, which wasn't really a kingdom at all, but it sort of was, and so they needed something. Then she explained how the collection of elk-drawn sledges, horse-drawn carriages, and fancy cars lined up on top of the crest were there to bring all the students to their residences. All the students, of course, except Autumn Lodgers, who had to walk. Charlie did a fine job of making it sound like they were the lucky ones, because walking across the whole of the island, they got to experience more of it than they would have through the windows of a car. Kuro was eager to disembark when the ferry finally settled at the Avalon docks. He had spent his summer trapped within the concrete confines of the orphanage. Now on the school island, he finally had a chance to properly stretch his legs. The others on deck of the ship were slow to move and responded negatively to Kuro's eagerness and urging to hurry. Charlie, who would normally have joined him for a dash across the island, said she needed to stretch out her limbs after several hours in the Blandlands. She had wrapped herself in blankets and propped herself against some railings to keep upright, but hadn't moved an inch for the whole Blandlands portion of the trip across the Saltwater Bay. She had been paralyzed by a childhood injury, and without the magic of the fairy realm to help her, she'd been stuck in the same position for hours. Arthur also excused himself from the run, claiming that he would only slow Kuro down and that he should help his sister get to her own residence. Marie explained that the two fireflies still needed a guide, and it would be rude to leave them behind. At their urging, Kuro abandoned his friends. He avoided the jam of students clogging the ramp by leaping from the deck of the ship onto the pier. He landed softly on all fours, cushioned by a pillow of air, and started to run. He sprinted through the hustle and bustle of the parking lot, past the waiting footmen and chauffeurs of the other houses, past old Pete on the baggage cart waiting for the lodger's luggage, and into the woods of the spring quarter. He let the wind build to push him even faster through the woods. His elation was quickly interrupted by an attack from above. A falcon dove out of the sky, screaming. It swooped low over him and stopped just short of gouging out his eyes. Kuro threw his hands up in defense and tripped to a standstill as the bird flapped and screeched at him angrily, barring his path. As he tried to fend off the falcon, he heard footfalls pounding up the road behind him, accompanied by a desperate cry, "Hey, hold up!" An older boy staggered to a stop just behind Kuro and struggled to catch his breath. The falcon settled in a nearby tree but looked ready to strike again if Kuro made a move. Kuro surmised that it was the winded boy's familiar. Kuro recognized the boy, a lodger, a couple years older than Kuro. He was unremarkable, neither tall nor short, dull brown hair, well-fed and unaccustomed to running as most wizards were. After several attempts, the boy managed to get enough air in his lungs to choke out, "I'm Willis Newton. I'm in charge of walking you first years, to the lodge." Kuro rolled his eyes as loudly as he could and waited for the new minder of the first years to recognize him.
"If you want to come back to the cart with me, we'll all go together," Willis continued. "Don't want anybody getting lost."
He gestured towards the baggage cart, still in sight, with nearly a dozen children gathered around it. "I'm not a first year, Willis." Willis cocked his head in surprise and examined Kuro more closely.
"Oh, you're Kuro, aren't you?" he said. "Sorry, I didn't recognize you with different hair. Also, well, you're kind of small, you know? My mistake."
Kuro looked back at the new students around the cart. They were, just like the year previous, either gaping at the wonders of the island or pretending to be too cool to gape at the wonders of the island. Also, just like the year previous, they were all bigger than Kuro. Noticeably so. Their heads all cleared the top of the wagon wheels. It hadn't bothered Kuro being the smallest at school when he was a first year, but still being the smallest annoyed him.
"I'll be going then," he said curtly.
"Of course," Willis replied, now full of friendly familiarity. "See you at the lodge. Make sure they don't start to eat without us."
Kuro feigned a smile and waved politely as he turned and restarted his journey to Autumn Lodge. The narrow road was packed with cars and carriages delivering the students too wealthy to walk the few hundred yards to Chateau du Printemps, and vastly too proper to sweat their way through the heat to get to Summerhill residence in their traveling clothes. Kuro bolted past the line of slow-moving vehicles, with a wind at his back, startling drivers and spooking horses as he went. But it wasn't until the line of black sedans discharged their passengers in the middle of summer and folded themselves down into briefcases that Kuro could really cut loose. He gathered a gale behind him so strong that his feet could hardly keep up. He bounded down the hill through the rest of summer at irresponsible speeds, a loose piece of gravel away from disaster the entire time. The stifling heat of the summer quarter broke, and the leaves started to change to the brilliant reds, yellows, and oranges of fall. The crisp autumn air, with its musty scent of damp moss and dry leaves, filled his lungs, letting him know that he was nearly home. Another mile of sprinting along the dirt road, as the pavement had given up in summer, had the Autumn Lodge in view. The broad, low log building welcomed him with the warm glow of a fire in the hearth leaking through the small windows at the front. Kuro paused nearly long enough to catch his breath and wipe his feet before pushing open the heavy wooden door and hopping inside. The lounge was just as he remembered it. Too much furniture and none of it matching. The wood floors, varnished too many times, were still full of chips and dents from years of mistreatment by incautious students. The couches and armchairs surrounding the fire were all faded and patched, with worn-out springs so that they swallowed anyone who sat in them. The soft light was just a bit too dim to read by without squinting, and the whole room was just the right amount of warm and smoky to fight away the chill autumn breeze outside. It was a perfectly engineered space for long naps and slow cups of hot chocolate. Something was unsettling about the lounge, however. It was eerily quiet. The occasional cracks and pops from the fire punctuated how otherwise silent the building was. Kuro had expected to be the first student to arrive. In fact, it was his intention. He had an ulterior motive for getting there before the others, a male-related mystery to unravel. And the Luton who worked at the lodge were his next best lead. Luton, who were conspicuously absent. Kuro hadn't considered that possibility. The Luton were always at the lodge. They were all but inescapable. The tiny people clambered in the rafters, chattering at each other in their squirrel-like voices. They climbed over and under all of the furniture, cleaning and tidying, happily interrupting and inconveniencing students to do so. They were an ever-present feature of the lodge, and they were entirely missing. Kuro checked the dining hall and then the kitchen. There were always at least a couple of Luton cooking or cleaning there, and the welcome back meal would need a lot of work. They were empty. They weren't just empty, it was as though they had been abandoned in a hurry. There were half-set tables, half-diced vegetables on cutting boards, bacon and broccoli sizzling in a frying pan, and a pot of peach and asparagus soup threatening to boil over. Worried that there was some unseen danger from which he should be evacuating,
Kuro quickly moved the pots off the heat and hurried back towards the exit, whereupon he found several Luton greeting the arriving students. Some of the high schoolers owned flying brooms and carpets of their own and got to the lodge nearly as quickly as Kuro. They were exchanging hellos and howdy-a-doos with the Luton, who were sitting casually right where they hadn't been moments before. Kuro heard us shuffling in the kitchen. He ran back to find it still empty, but the pots returned to the rightful place on the heat. Baffled and a little numb, he sank into a sofa in the lounge and waited for everyone else to arrive. The room gradually filled with the familiar cacophony of the lodge. Students started up games and conversations. Familiars chased each other around the room, bats, budgies, cats, and cobras playing a game of tag. Kuro was slowly joined on the couch by some of the other kids from his year, Magna, Gregory, and Arthur. The first two were so eager to share their stories of summer that it saved Kuro or Arthur from having to say anything. The smell of food drifting in from the kitchen made everyone ravenous and impatient, but it wouldn't be served until the first years arrived. While they all understood why the new students walked together in a group, it didn't stop the complaints about how slow they were. They could only move as fast as their slowest member, but keeping clumped up avoided any of them being lost, eaten, or exploded on their way, which would delay mealtime even more. The food wasn't served until they arrived because it was an excellent incentive for the older students to go and find them quickly should any go missing. The arrival of old Pete with the baggage cart offered some distraction, for with him came the room assignments. He shuffled into the lodge, took a deep breath as if to shout to the room into silence, but just let it out again in a slow wheeze. He handed the list off to one of the senior high school girls before throwing his beard over his shoulder and wandering back to help make dinner. The girl, probably the smallest in her year, interrupted a game of cards by climbing onto the table on which it was being played. "Oi, stuff it!" she yelled. It was clear why Pete had chosen this girl as his speaker for the year. She was impossibly loud for her size, and her voice carried an implied threat that her eyes promised to make good on. The room hushed, allowing her to continue in a volume and tone that was merely distressing rather than jaw-clenchingly terrifying. "I'm Catherine Ammersmith. Pete's put me in charge of yelling for this year. You can call me Katie if you want. You could also try calling me Cat, but not if you like walking without a limp. I've got room assignments here, so keep quiet till I'm done." She read through the list, starting at the senior high school girls and working backwards down to the lower years. Kuro paid the list little mind until she reached the girls of his year. "Sing and Tanaka, room 6. Cook and Akinwande, room 5. Greenwood and Betty, room 4. It was the same pairings as the previous year, which all the girls seemed pleased with. Kuro noted Charlie and Marie's room number for them, since they were still walking with the first years. Catherine then repeated the same for the boys, finally arriving at some familiar names at the bottom of the list. "Cassidy and Keegan, room 9. Wood and Hayashi, room 8. Nobody's in room 7, because they still haven't fixed it after what Milton did to it last year. Caldoon and Zimmerman, room 6. Right, that's it. Go get your luggage." She jammed the list in her pocket and hopped off the table, allowing conversation to resume. Kuro let out a long sigh. He shouldn't have been surprised that he had been omitted from the list, as he was a perpetual clerical error. He looked to Arthur, whose face was a tableau in horror. "Hayashi?" said Arthur, the color washing out of him completely. Arthur was not good with new people, and people were generally not comfortable with changelings. It had taken half of the previous year for him to get used to rooming with Kuro, and he didn't seem eager to repeat the process. "Probably a third year without a roommate," suggested Kuro. Even if that were true, it wasn't good news. The odd student without a roommate was rarely the most likable of the group. Kuro and Arthur had lucked out by being amicably strange the year before. Hopefully, the fact that they hadn't heard of Hayashi meant that he was shy rather than terrible. They sighed in collective resignation before separating. Arthur to find his new room and new roommate, Kuro to find the keeper of the list. He navigated the crowd and found Catherine hauling one end of her large wooden trunk towards the girls' dormitory, the other end in the mouth of her familiar. She was difficult enough to approach when she was just yelling. Being in the company of a mountain lion did not help the matter. It took 3 tries for Kuro to make a noise loud enough for her to hear. "Miss Hammersmith? Could I bother you?" She responded by dropping her trunk and laughing.
Miss Hammersmith, well, that's good.
She shook her head at the foolishness of her juniors.
Do I look like a teacher to you?
Crow took a moment to guess at what answer she would prefer.
No?
Right, she said. Call me Katie. Not miss anything. Not unless you want to be sleeping outside, that is.
That's sort of the thing, Katie. I might be sleeping outside already. I don't think I was on the list.
She gave him a skeptical scowl.
I'm sure I saw your name.
She grumbled as she pulled the list back out.
You know my name?
Of course.
She waved away his surprise like a moth flitting too close to her head. After all the stuff that happened last year, everyone knows who you are. Kuro was only given a moment to process the horrible truth of what she'd just said. He suddenly wished that he could be sleeping outside, hidden and unknown in the woods.
Yeah, there you are.
She thumbed a spot on the list. Unless there's another Kuro I don't know about, you should have been listening better. She presented the list to Kuro. There he was, room 8, Arthur Wood and Kuro Hayashi. He stared at the strange second name that followed his own. He had woken that morning convinced that he would solve a mystery. It seemed instead that he was accumulating more.
Thank you for listening to Stealing from Wizards. If you liked our show, please consider rating or reviewing on iTunes. If you want to support this podcast or just can't wait for the next chapter, the full book is available on Amazon, Kobo, and Indigo. Our theme music was written by Camille Saint-Saëns, transcribed by Franz Liszt, performed by Rebecca Verdun, and used with permission. This episode was produced by Jim Tigwell.